Good morning, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC, and your host. We have a great turnout today for an excellent guest. We appreciate that so many of you are circulating the invitation to your friends, and let me encourage you to continue to do that. I also want to thank you for the many excellent questions we've received. As you know, you can't ask questions directly during the call, but our email line is open. Send your questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. We hold our calls to 45 minutes. We started that when you were all working at your desks in office buildings, but now that most of us have a slightly different view, it still seems like a good idea. So let's get started. Dr. Stephen J. Blank is Senior Fellow at the Eurasia Program of the Foreign Policy Research Institute. He's an internationally known expert on Russia and the former Soviet Union. A former professor of National Security Studies at the Strategic Studies Institute of the U.S. Army War College, he has testified before Congress, consulted for the CIA, major think tanks, and foundations, and held conferences here and in Europe. He's a frequent commentator in the media, both in the U.S. and abroad. Dr. Blank's expertise covers the entire spectrum of Russian and post-Soviet security issues, including defense strategy, arms control, information warfare, energy, U.S. foreign and defense policy as it relates once to the Cold War and now to Russia, and European and Asian security. Dr. Blank has taught at the University of California, University of Texas, and was professor of national security studies at the U.S. Air War College. His PhD in Russian history is from the University of Chicago. He has published over 900 articles and monographs on Soviet Russian, U.S., Asian, and European military and foreign policies. Readers of the JPC's In Focus quarterly magazine have read and appreciated his work several times in the last couple of years. His list of publishing credentials is extensive, but let me recommend two books. On today's subject, Dr. Blank is the co-author of Russia in the Middle East, published by the Jamestown Foundation. He's also the author of The Sorcerer as Apprentice, Stalin's Commissariat of Nationalities, which I have to say I picked up for the title, but I found to be fascinating as a look at the early years of communist Russia. He will talk today about Russian aims in the Middle East, including its long-term plans, and the Russia-Saudi oil war. The COVID-19 pandemic, including its spread in Russia itself, has an impact on each of these areas of Russian policy. Again, if you have a question, info@jewishpolicycenter.org. Steve Blank, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. You may be the only person who read the Sorcerer as Apprentice. It was my PhD dissertation way back when. I'm happy to be speaking to your audience today. I hope everybody's having a wonderful holiday in spite of all the difficulties that we all know about. And I'm glad that you were able to find the time to join me talking about Russia and the Middle East. So let me cut right to the heart of the argument. There's an enormous amount of commentary as to what Russia's goals are. And the problem with a lot of this is that they fasten on one or two goals. Any major political event has more than one goal. And furthermore, to the extent that it succeeds or fails, other goals become apparent. And this certainly is the case with Russia because it succeeded so far in Syria that it was able to parlay that into other objectives that grow out of that. So today, we may see 8 total objectives that I think are important to keep in mind, and they're all out there at the same time. You can't say one is more important than the other. Although I think the constant one in Russian foreign policy, and not just in the Middle East, is Russia's obsession with being recognized abroad as a great global power. The greatest insult any American president has given was when Barack Obama called it merely a regional power. This actually incentivized them to go attack American interests all over the world, which they had already been doing, but to do so with renewed vigor and infuriated them. And one of the major aspects of Syria is that their success there has forced us to see them as a major player in the Middle East. And what they want, and that's the second goal, is recognition not just of a global status, but that they are America's equal in being what you might call a security manager in the Middle East that has to be involved in any major issue in the Middle East. And we know there are lots of those. Third, it is determined to support Bashar Assad because he is an ally, and also because Iran requested this in early 2015. They said if he failed, then the government would go to pieces and they would lose Syria to a pro-Western organization. They did not want to see either Iran or Syria fall into a pro-Western stance. This does not mean that they are Iran's allies, but they are partners with Iran on a lot of issues having to do with Syria. Fourth, Moscow has steadily claimed that it wants to thwart color revolutions. I think you all know what color revolutions are. If you don't, we can talk about it later. But Russia believes that all these revolutions are merely U.S. orchestrated conspiracies. Now, this is a hallmark of the paranoid mind, which is the collective mindset of the Russian political elite. And they see that as a threat aimed not just at the country in question, but at them. Going back in 2011, then President Medvedev said that the Arab Spring in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Syria, and Bahrain, and other places was aimed at Russia, which is the last thing was the last thing in anybody's mind at that time. But that again shows you how obsessed they are with themselves and with the paranoid mindset of threat assessments. So that leads to the fifth objective, which is to thwart U.S. power wherever possible. And by any means, whether it's military, informational, economic, or whatever. This leads also as well to the sixth, which is their obsession with gaining leverage on Middle Eastern energy supplies, not only from Syria, but certainly including Syria, to Europe. Having a voice on pipelines, you just saw their attempt now to do that, and they suffered a major defeat at the hands of the Saudis and at the U.S., which helped them broker an agreement to save face, but they lost millions of dollars and they fell flat on their face in their effort to drive Saudi Arabia out of key markets. Seventh, related to this, is the effort to project military power beyond Russia's borders. Today, there are Russian troops all over the Middle East, Syria, Libya, the Mediterranean Escadra, which is part of their Navy. They are obtaining bases along the Red Sea coast and seeking more bases than they have already in Syria and access to ports in Cyprus. And they are looking for other bases, Alexandria, Libya, Yemen. Essentially, those of you who are a bit older and remember the Soviet Union may remember Moscow had all kinds of naval bases in the 70s and 80s in the Middle East. They are trying to replicate that status to the greatest degree possible. Finally, Russia talks a great deal, or at least used to talk a great deal, that they were in Syria to stop terrorism. Now, this is utter nonsense, because what they really did is they encouraged all the terrorists in the North Caucasus, of whom there were many, to go to Syria in 2011, 12, 13, and 14, so that they could export their terrorist threat to Syria. And then when they sent in the troops a year later, they claimed they were fighting terrorism. So this is a classic Russian gambit. We create a problem, and then we intervene to say we're solving the problem we created. You have to take us seriously. So in sum, those are the objectives of Russian policy. The instruments are very clear. They're the classic instruments of Russian foreign policy and to a great degree of other people's foreign policy. The U.S. Army calls the instruments of power the dime, diplomacy, information, military, economic power. All those are there. Energy, economic power, arms sales is both military and economic, information warfare, which they do a lot of in the Middle East, but does not get a lot of recognition here because the language barrier, and diplomacy. Their diplomats are all over the place. They're very good. They're very knowledgeable, and they're completely devoted to the Russian state. And then finally, military. It's not just arms sales, but it is now power projection of forces into Syria, Libya. If we were talking about sub-Saharan Africa, we talk about that as well. The use of private militaries and militias and former terrorists and tribes, mercenaries, if you like to call them that, private military warriors, guys who like the sound of guns and want to be at the center of military action. The Russians are using them in Libya and in Syria, the Turks are too, for that matter. And this is also now an instrument of Russian military power and Russian security politics, not only in the Middle East, but also across Africa. So those are the objectives. Those are the instruments, and I'm ready to take your questions.
Okay, let's start with a multi-part question. And so I'll give you all the parts, and you can play with it. Vladimir Putin has called the collapse of the Soviet Union the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. Today's Russia is much smaller and less populous than the Soviet Union. Here are the questions. How successful has Putin been in modernizing Russia's military? Can its current forces, including asymmetric and cyber warfare capabilities, limit or deny U.S. military access and movement in Europe? And third, how close is Putin to restoring the old Soviet reach?
Okay. You know, the Talmud always said that you should answer multiple questions in sequence. So let me do the first one first. The military modernization has been very impressive in the last 10 years. But I think they, before the coronavirus, even they had hit their ceiling and were operating on this economic constraints. Although the modernization is extremely effective, it does have gaps. Shipbuilding, capital ships, is a really weak point. They build terrific missiles with great lethality and now precision strike, and they're putting them on smaller ships and submarines. Their submarines are very good. Their capital ships are really bad, to put it mildly, and they have real difficulties outfitting and building them. Nevertheless, their military modernization has been effective. They have a very imposing range of nuclear and now hypersonic weapons, short, medium, and long range, tailored to all kinds of contingencies. Their air defense networks, what we call anti-access area denial, along with anti-ship capabilities, are very formidable, and they stretch from the Arctic to the Mediterranean. One of the military objectives in regard to Syria and Libya and the Mediterranean fleet is to extend that A2AD bubble, as we would call it, as far into the Mediterranean as possible to deny NATO access to the Black Sea. So they can limit access to Russia. They cannot limit access to NATO countries or to countries, say, like Finland or Sweden at present, but they are in position to pose a formidable offensive threat. And in time of war, they will do a lot of damage in trying to limit that access. They may have some success. I don't think at the end of the day they can completely block NATO, not just U.S., NATO access to the front lines, which is the Baltic, Poland, and then the Black Sea states, but they can inflict an enormous amount of damage, and they, I think, might be prepared to use nuclear weapons first if they thought they were losing. They will certainly threaten NATO with nuclear weapons as part of their offensive war plans. They've made that clear. They're doing that every day with these overflights that you hear about. The other day there was some in Alaska. So that's the sum total of their capabilities. Right now, they can't limit access. They will try very hard to do so. To the extent that NATO keeps reinforcing itself, as has been the case up until now, it will probably be more difficult for the Russians than imagined, but they will inflict terrible casualties on NATO and terrible losses on member states there. And the third question is,
how close is Putin to restoring the old Soviet reach?
He's not really that close. He's trying, but they are trying in Venezuela. They're trying in Cuba. They're certainly trying in the Middle East and Africa. And they have achieved some level of success compared to where they were 15, 20 years ago. Much better off in that sense. But to the extent that we carry out intelligent policies, their access will be limited. And also, there's a fundamental problem in the Middle East. And the United States has learned this, or should have learned it long ago. Anybody who aspires to be the security manager in the Middle East is letting himself in for unending problems. And right now, they are beginning to experience that. In Syria, They have achieved a great deal, but they have not been able to bring the civil war there to a close, to oust Turkey, and to make sure that Bashar Assad's rule is unchallenged. In Libya, they are supporting General Haftar, and Turkey and others are supporting the government. This is a very strange alignment. The U.S. actually is supporting Haftar, and France is. The Saudis are supporting, and Egypt is supporting Haftar, but the Turks and others are supporting the government. And in heavy fighting, Haftar's forces lost a series of towns yesterday and last week. So the Libya thing is not going all that well for them right now. Third, this oil crisis where they tried to force Saudi Arabia to give up market share, that's what really was going on here, blew up in their face. And they were lucky to get out of it with this compromise that President Trump helped arrange. But they are very active diplomatically in every other way in the Middle East. What we have to understand is that for Russia, there is no end game in the Middle East. They are not looking to bring about a situation of stability or peace. They are looking to continue the game. As long as the game goes on, or I should say the games, plural, go on, they will have opportunities to meddle, to intervene, and get on everybody's side, trying to be a partner to everybody and an interlocutor, and make deals with every side to advance their own interests.
Thank you. So NATO brought us another question. If it's unlikely that if Russia doesn't see the physical conquering of NATO as a possibility, is Russia's goal to subvert it with oil pipelines and energy supplies and simply make it less willing to fight?
Yes. Russia has been waging war on NATO since 2005. That may come as a surprise to your audience, but actually that's when the Minister of Defense told the Academy of the General Staff that they were at war with Europe. Now, it's not a shooting war, as everybody knows, but those instruments, information warfare, energy, subversion, all these things, and of course the military threat, are all part of Russia's arsenal. And they are deployed every day, constantly, rain or shine. And they are using those weapons every day. So the problem never goes away. Even if they don't have success or they have failure, they don't stop. They go back to the drawing board. They keep coming at us, and doing that, which means that we constantly have to keep building resilience and strength and exposing the threat every single day. Because that's the only way they can survive, is by the postulation of a threat. And what's more, they believe, given their own awareness of their own illegitimacy, that they are under threat from within and without. And therefore, they have to keep doing this.
So this raises a question about internal Russian policies. How much will low oil prices, and I know they're expected to rise, but they're not going to rise that much. How much will low oil prices hurt the Kremlin's budget and its ability to pay off its own citizens through fiscal expenditures such as social programs and subsidies, number one? And number two, can Putin's grip on power be challenged? If so, by whom?
Well, in this case, we don't see anybody who can challenge Putin. And if there is somebody out there who wants to do so, he's keeping very quiet for obvious reasons. But the real challenge is not going to just be low oil prices. It's the double whammy of low oil prices and the coronavirus, because it's hitting them much harder than they're willing to admit. And they've already had to admit that things are going badly in Moscow. And in the regions, God only knows what's happening, because the medical quality of medical care in the boondocks, so to speak, is pretty awful. They had determined in early 2020, when they reshuffled the government, actually to take a kind of neo-Keynesian approach. They thought they had a lot of money saved up and that the ruble was strong and that they could go ahead with major projects on social welfare, infrastructure, and in the Arctic. And they actually published a new strategy guide to the Arctic just before all this broke loose. The government, for complex reasons, decided to launch this energy war against the Saudis, and at the same time as coronavirus was already making itself felt abroad, and they walked into a buzzsaw. So they lost several hundred million dollars because demand crashed, and with it, energy prices, to a level that they cannot sustain. The coronavirus is obligating them to spend millions of dollars on healthcare and to forego millions of dollars of income because people are not working, just like here. And as a result, the plans for the Arctic, the plans for the kind of neo-Keynesian social welfare policy, I think they're dead on arrival, to be honest. I mean, they're going to be on paper, but I don't see how Russia can pay for them unless it is willing to experience very high levels of inflation. And Putin is a deficit hawk, so I don't see that. So they are going to be in a very difficult place economically and therefore politically. That's going to constrain, I believe, to some degree, at least military spending, although that remains to be seen. But there will obviously be more social discontent expressed in social economic discontent. But I don't see anybody willing, capable, or ready to challenge Putin for leadership.
So add to this the question of demographics. We've heard for a long time that Russia was on the edge of a demographic collapse. Number one, is it? And number two, if so, how might that influence Moscow's aggressiveness or willing to accommodate the United States and others, maybe including China?
Well, they're already accommodating China. I've written on this a lot, and my belief is, and the latest article I published just said so, that one of the reasons for Russia's continuing probes is that it has to prove to itself and to China that it's a great power and that China should therefore take it seriously as an ally. And I use the word ally because they are allies, although it's a unique kind of alliance. It's not a NATO alliance. The demographics, I don't know about collapse, but demographic decline, certainly. Collapse may be too strong a word. Our colleagues try to shy away from, going out on that kind of limb because collapse is a pretty radical outcome. But there's no doubt that they're experiencing a demographic decline. Even though Putin had invested lots of money in healthcare before this, and they had actually had some positive results, it's still going to decline. Healthcare is not great. This virus is going to expose a lot of deficiencies in the healthcare system and in the public health of the population. And we can also expect that climate change will impact this as well, particularly in the Arctic, because global warming and the consequences thereof has the potential to devastate the Arctic and much of Russia as a result.
Thank you. I think you answered at least one of the questions in front of me, but here's another one. How deeply has the Russian arms industry penetrated the weapon procurement processes of U.S. allied governments? Is the U.S. at risk of losing leverage over countries such as Turkey, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, all of whom have bought major systems from Moscow?
Well, Turkey is, and sees itself, more importantly, as a great power in the making. Now, we can dispute that, but what I'm talking about is their perception, not yours and mine, or the audience's. Turkey has a robust defense industry, as they just proved in Syria, and they inflicted a lot of damage on the Syrian military and cost the Russians hundreds of millions of dollars of weapons. The Russo-Turkish relationship, although it is a source of endless annoyance here, is a transactional one, because if you look at it in its totality, they are rivals in Syria, but they are trying to manage the rivalry. But ultimately, Turkey's aims are incompatible with those of Bashar Assad in Russia. Second, Turkey is buying steadily less energy from Russia than it used to. If you look at the energy figures, Turkey's energy purchases from Russia in the last 18 months are way down, and their purchases from the United States are way up, and that's not by accident. Libya, as I mentioned, also not an accident. So Turkey is an independent actor, and as far as the Turks are concerned, nobody is going to really have leverage on them unless they are in some sort of partnership mode. So that's what the relationship with Russia is. There's partnership and there's rivalry, and that's what is going to be the case with the United States. But they support NATO And so a lot of key issues. For example, they are very strong supporters of Ukraine. And they're even helping Ukraine rebuild its defense industry. So that cannot be a source of comfort to Moscow. So you see already three areas where Russian and Turkish interests clash. And Syria, too, will likely in the future see examples of that. Egypt and Saudi Arabia are doing what Middle Eastern governments have done for at least 60, 70 years, which is plaguing both sides against the middle. The Saudis go to Russia when they want to force the United States to do something that they want and say, if you don't do that, we'll go to the Russians. So we either sweeten the pot, so to speak, or if we don't, then they make a deal with the Russians. But they play this game over again. And the energy crisis you just saw shows that the Saudis and the Russians are not particularly in love with each other. It's, again, a marriage of convenience. The same can be said for Egypt. U.S. policy in Egypt made a lot of mistakes. The Egyptians wanted to buy weapons, so they took advantage of the opportunity that Russia gave them, and they bought weapons. But they are working with the United States and Israel as far as energy issues in the Eastern Mediterranean. We're on the same side as Egypt and Libya. It happens to be the same side as Russia, which is, again, a regional issue. So it's much more complex than do you have leverage or not. These countries are not just going to simply dance to the tune of our pipe. That must has to be understood.
Okay, so that leads to parts of two other questions. With Russia being so heavily involved in Syria in support of the Assad government, do you see Russia serving as a deterrent or an enabler against Iran's continuing threats in the region, including against Israel?
They're both. Again,
great. Thanks.
Look, this is the Middle East, and nothing is, nothing. Yes, they deter Iran from provoking Israel, and they've made it clear to Iran they're not going to support that. They're also always been opposed to Iran having a nuclear weapon. I mean, although the way they go about that is very different than us. At the same time, they're enabling Iran by selling weapons to Iran, supporting it in Syria up to a point. Selling weapons to groups like Hezbollah, which then supporting the political recognition of Hamas. As again, Moscow, as the Yiddish proverb says, wants to dance at two weddings at the same time. And I could say it in Yiddish, but I don't know if everybody would understand it. So you have to understand that Moscow wants to be part of every game that's going on in the Middle East. But doesn't want to be bound to one side or the other. So it wants to be able to hunt with Israel, to run with the foxes and hunt with the hares, as the British proverb goes. So they want a very good relationship with Israel, but they want a really good relationship with Iran, too, because they don't want an Iranian-Israeli war in the Middle East. What they want is Russian status as a major player and that Bashar Assad prevails and can reconstitute his state and allow the Russians to enjoy the fruits of their investment. But they don't want a general Middle Eastern conflagration. So they, again, have tried to balance between Saudi Arabia and Iran in that arena.
So here's the other half of that question. Is it possible that between Syria and Turkey and a nuclearizing Iran and Saudi Arabia, is it possible that Russia has bitten off more than Putin can chew? And if that's the case, what are the possible downsides for Russia?
It's very possible, but we haven't seen it yet. They have so far been able to juggle all these balls in the air. However, you see some of the costs coming in now. They tried to strike at Saudi Arabia, and they lost. They lost severely. They are involved in Syria, and after almost 5 years, they still haven't achieved their great political objective of putting Assad back in. And in Libya, they're also facing difficulties, as we saw. Their economic power is going to be clipped by this combination of energy prices and coronavirus crisis, and the fact that they've never reformed their economy to maximize Russia's economic capability. I think that they are in the medium to long term, that is not any time immediately, but by the end of this year and next year, you will see that severe strains. Now, whether they can cope with that or not is anybody's guess, but they are looking, they're going to be looking for partners. The problem is, to the degree that you partner with somebody in the Middle East, you alienate somebody else. And at some point in time, they may have to make a choice. They haven't had to do so yet, but I don't know that they can continue to dance at all these weddings without having to give gifts to the bride and the, and so on. And those gifts are serious. They're the currency of strategic transactions. So you can't give a definitive answer, but I think that day is coming.
Okay, so let's continue that thought. Given their disparities in size, the contradictory natures of their political systems and differing strategic goals in the Middle East, to what extent can Moscow and Jerusalem cooperate tactically or in the long term?
They can continue to cooperate tactically for quite some time because they have, at least Netanyahu, and this is assuming Mr. Netanyahu stays in power, a new Israeli government, you know, will do whatever it does. But Netanyahu has recognized the importance of working with Russia where Israel's vital interests are at stake and at reaching limited tactical understandings. As one of my colleagues says, we understand Russia. We are not Russia's partner. We have strategic empathy that we understand where it's coming from and how it thinks and what it wants to achieve. And to the extent that that is compatible with what Israel wants to achieve, we can make arrangements, reach understandings, and so on. But by no means is this a match made in heaven. Now, there's also a substantial economic trade between Russia and Israel as well, which is one of the reasons why Russia takes Israel seriously and vice versa. But this is going to be purely a tactical relationship, and it's not going to go beyond that.
Okay. Turning your attention to the other side of Russia, would you give us an assessment of Russian intentions toward the Baltic states?
Well, they're always nefarious, but they want to subvert those governments. They want to keep them under pressure and want to reorient them politically and economically, if they can, towards Russia and neutralize NATO's ability to act. But I seriously doubt that they're going to attack because they understand that an Article 5 contingency leads to highly unpredictable and escalatory consequences that they don't want. Nevertheless, they will use the military to make threats, and because they believe themselves a threat, at risk. And therefore, this tension is inherent in the regional condition and is not going away.
Thank you. So we have two more questions for the last 10 minutes, and one's a sort of present question and one's a sort of future question. So let's go present first. Russia under Putin assassinates opponents at home and abroad, attempts to undermine Western elections, including America's, and democratic societies in general, and acts overseas with wholesale brutality. The question is, should the United States be trying to delegitimize and change Putin's regime? That's an America question as much as it is a Russia question.
Yeah, look, the Russians think we're doing this anyway. You could ask anybody in our field and you'll get different answers. We are being attacked right and left for doing this. And so my feeling is if you're going to be attacked for killing a sheep, you might as well kill the goat too. And second, because supporting critics of the regime is supporting human rights. Now, Russia's not going to become a democracy anytime soon. And I doubt in my lifetime that it will be, although it would be nice if it happened. But I think we have an obligation as Americans to point out where Russia is falling short on human rights. They will do the same to us, and we have to respond to just criticism where it's there. But I wouldn't call this regime change. I would say we're supporting international treaties and conventions that the Russians have signed and that they must live up to.
Okay. And the last question, because this fits into my theory of what you can help us best understand, because you've started studying Russia in its infancy as a communist country. You've gone through the Cold War, you've gone through World War II, you've gone through the collapse of communism and all of the rest of this and the reinvention of Russia. For a lot of people, it's impossible to think of Russia today without Vladimir Putin in charge. Putin seems to have the same opinion. But someday it will happen. So if you take the long view, where do you see Russia in 5 years, 10 years, 25 years?
Well, assuming I'm around.
I don't know if any of us will be around, but
I see further stagnation into the midterm, maybe long term. And I don't know when Putin leaves the scene, but he will, against his will, but he will. The next ruler, and it'll probably be a man, the next ruler, because it's a severely anti-feminist political culture, the next ruler will come to power as part of a coalition initially, and he will have to build that coalition to make himself predominant. And that's been the trend. But he will also have to face the fact that the country is in very bad economic and social shape, that there are urgent reforms that need to be made, and he will be under tremendous pressure to do so. Now, this is true, for example, for Alexander II. It was true for Khrushchev. It was true for Gorbachev as well. The first two of those made reforms. Alexander II was about to make even more reforms, and then he was killed because of the pressure from the revolutionaries who killed him in the end. Khrushchev was sacked for making too many uncoordinated reforms and trying to get rid of the deadwood around him. That deadwood unseated Khrushchev. They ruled for another 20 years and drove the country to total stagnation. Gorbachev lost control of the entire system, and we know what happened there. The Soviet Union fell apart. Now, I don't know what's going to happen to Putin's successor and when that's going to be, but the Russia he inherits will be severely diminished as a great power, and I think economically and politically as well. But they will have nuclear weapons and a formidable military, so you can't count them out of the game. But the period after Putin will be one of upheaval because of the tremendous pressure for reform, and what's more, the tremendous pressure inside the top of the government for somebody to emerge as leader and to build a winning coalition and agenda. And that agenda will probably be a reform agenda, but we don't know how far it'll go and what reforms he will undertake.
So in some ways, are we going back to the post-World War II era where Russia had nuclear weapons, but not necessarily a ground capability or an air capability that threatened us? On the other hand, you had to take them seriously because they could nuke us. Are we headed backwards?
Actually, after World War II, they didn't have, immediately after World War II, they had a large ground force. They didn't have nukes till 1949. Prospect will always be there as long as Russia believes that it must be a great global power at all costs. There's a lot of Russian analysts and elites believe, and I can quote them, understand, if Russia is not a great power, then it's nothing. And that statement has to sink in, because all of their foreign policy is tied to this intense belief that they are a great global power, that they must do whatever they have to do to be taken seriously. And we know in interpersonal relationships that people who feel that they are neglected and not being heard, if they're driven far enough and hard enough, will explode. I mean, we all know of cases like that, or have read of it, or seen it in the movies or TV. The same thing is true in world politics. They believe that they are destined, almost genetically endowed, that they must be a great global power, and that they must do whatever is possible to get people to take them seriously.
Do you have an uplifting note on which to end this program, or should we just call it quits and have a drink?
Well, since most liquor is chametz, we can't have a drink now. But you can have Schlivovitz, I mean, if you like that stuff. That's Serbian plum liquor, and believe me, that's powerful medicine. Look, there is an uplifting. I mean, the system that Putin built is not going to outlast him. And I don't think Russia is going to start a global war in order to reform itself. But they're going to make a lot of trouble, I suspect, for the next several years, because that's the nature of the beast. But we have it within our capabilities to blunt the threat. What we need is coherent strategic leadership in the West. Unfortunately, it's not there, neither here nor in Europe. But that doesn't mean it cannot come back soon in the future. There will be other leaders, there'll be other opportunities, and perhaps the current crisis will throw up strong Western leadership, just as the crisis of the 1930s, which in some ways is what we are going through now, threw up very strong leadership in the West. In the 30s, we had some pretty poor leaders, but then by World War II, we had Churchill, Roosevelt, de Gaulle, which is a fairly impressive, and Eisenhower as general. It's a fairly impressive team. So I am not in despair about what's going to happen, but we have to take it seriously. There's an old Soviet joke, and this here where I'll conclude. A man comes to a rabbi in a shtetl, and he says to him, "Rabbi, I'm not a religious man, but I know you are, and I respect your commitment. Is there going to be a war?" And the rabbi says, "Let me ponder the question." He comes back, he ponders the holy books, he prays to God. A week later, he comes back to the man and says, "There's not going to be a war, but there's going to be such a struggle for peace that no stone will be left unturned. A lot of stones are going to be overturned, as is the case now, but I'm not certain that it's going to lead to global war." In the Middle East, however, you can't be optimistic about anything because there's so many loose cannons playing games there. But I would not be ready to predict a European or major great power conflagration anytime soon.
I think that's a happy note on which to end, or at least an uplifting note. Steve Blank, on behalf of the Jewish Policy Center, thank you for your insights, and thank you for enlightening us. Have a great end of Passover holiday, and to everyone else, please stay inside and stay safe. Thank you.
Thank you.